I'm going to try to turn the energy up when we record, but I'm feeling very, like, low-key.
I am also kind of, too. That's why I'm drinking a lot of caffeine.
I feel
trying
myself
to, like,
being very mumbly right
yeah.
now.
It's why I also pounded a soda before coming in, because I feel very zapped by the heat.
I mean, it's fitting with the movie, though, today, so if you want to just sort of speak at this time, the entire time.
Yeah, actually, why don't we all podcast just like this? We'll talk at Richard Dreyfuss in... that movie we watched.
Richard Dreyfuss in that movie
right.
we watched.
You just did not speak really
what
at all.
What movie was that, though?
It was called Who is Cletus Tout?
Right, Who is Cletus Tout?
No, if we're really doing it, we have to, like...
Smile at each other?
No. I'm saying if we're doing the singing detective thing, we all just sort of mutter, but in full
yeah,
writing
just,
punctuation.
Yeah, just
comma, period.
comma. I love that idea, period.
Yeah.
It's just... See, I feel like we have to keep it at, like, a very low level, and then when we cut to a pop song playing, the pop song is...
Let's go to the hop! Let's go to the hop!
And then we just make up after, well, I don't know what we're going to do.
Yeah, it's so... I had the movie up so I can do the year and the stuff.
Okay, I'll do the synopsis because I have it open.
Yeah. What?
2003? I'm sorry.
Yeah, could you turn your face fully away from the microphone?
Just sort of keep it kind of low.
Yeah, okay.
I don't even know if the mic is picking that. Hold on. Do that again.
Hey, what's going on? I'm just going to stop right now. I just said it.
It's like barely...
making lines.
It's room tone, essentially.
Like gorgeous wife.
I think you would probably hear it.
For some reason.
What a stupid whore. What a fucking whore.
Fuck out!
I don't know why she resents me so much, the slut.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy is for sale.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Why Did We Watch This, the podcast where three friends sit down, have a nice drink, watch a troubled movie, talk about what was good, what was bad, and how we could all do it so much better. I am your host for this week, Lee. It's a big fucking moon if it isn't, Delahanty.
I'm Chris. Don't mind the bills. It's where I grow my mold, Ravel.
And I am Brendan. Muppets and Puppets!
Trishler.
And if you
it doesn't get shouted out that way,
yes.
doesn't it?
Yeah. That's a full sort of method acting.
Yes. Yes, it is.
It's also giving me Eddie Redmayne and Jupiter Ascending, where
yes.
you mumble, 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 until you yell! Anyway.
Lee, I know you said sometimes we talk about a bad movie, but sometimes do we sing about a bad movie? Or do we lip sync while other people sing about
a
bad movie?
I don't sing about it. And you can't tell from any of the nicknames and all the garbage we've been talking so far. We've just finished watching 2003 is The Singing Detective. This is directed by Keith Gordon, screenplay with Dennis Potter, who also wrote the BBC show, who also wrote the book. Starring Robert Downey Jr., Robin Wright, Jeremy Northam, Katie Holmes, Mel Gibson, so many more characters.
Alfred Woodard, Saul Rubinek is back, John Polito.
Saul Rubin back,
baby.
Now, just wait till you get to the Saul Rubin crack.
it's a stacked cast.
Did you
already
say Carlos Gugino? Carla Gugino?
I did not.
Okay.
Adrian Brody, I mean, yeah.
These are, we've long exhausted the
yeah.
names of people that I would know.
Fair enough.
Yep.
They're all, after that, it's just faces to
sure.
me. It's quite the stack cast for a relatively small budget.
Yes,
yeah.
It is.
You said it was only a couple mil?
Eight mil.
Yeah, and I guess at the time, they would not have been so crazy good, some of them. Like, often what we were saying, kind of.
Yeah,
broke out a bit
yeah
later.
People who would break out big
yes.
in the future. But at the time, we're probably just sort of respected actors who people didn't really, by and large, know.
Yes. And I mentioned briefly, this is adapted from... This movie
BBC,
is adapted from
yes.
a BBC show, which is adapted from a book.
Well, the book, from what I understand, it's like it's loosely adapted.
Loosely
he just kind of like
yeah, yeah,
pilfered
yeah.
plot points from the book. So it's not
yeah.
really like there is a book that became the TV show. It's more
yeah.
like he threw bits of the book
but
into
there's,
the show.
There's a sort of storied history
yeah,
of
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
Anyway, as usual, we did have to have something potable.
Yes.
Not potable.
No, not potable.
Not potable.
potable. So what did we drink this week?
The drink that we made is called the Heartbreak of Psoriasis. It is 1.5 ounces of whiskey, 1/2 ounce of Aperol, 1/2 ounce of honey syrup, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, mint leaves, and tobacco bitters. Mm. You add whiskey, Aperol, honey syrup, lemon juice, and a few dashes of tobacco bitters into a cocktail shaker. Add mint leaves and muddle until the oils have been released. Add the ice to the cocktail shaker and shake it multiple times. Strain the contents into a glass over ice and garnish with some mint leaves.
I like that tobacco bitters have made a return.
They have to, because I have a whole bottle
of course. Them. But I thought it was very fitting for
A noir-ish
story and tale. I thought this is maybe one of the best drinks.
Yeah, this was
in a while.
Great drink.
No notes. It was easy to drink. Yeah. I did get a headache. I'm not going to ding the drink for that. Sometimes I get a headache.
Sins over here.
Some nights I'm lucky and I get to have a drink, and some nights I have a drink and I get a headache and I gotta pop the Excedrin.
Ding.
But it was a delicious drink.
It was, yeah. Yes. I will be making this one again at some point.
I downed it so quickly just because it does go down very smoothly.
Yeah, it did.
I didn't because I wanted to have a drink with my fries.
With your fries.
But I did sip it.
I thought it was pretty, seemed pretty
hey girl,
simple to
it?
Make.
Hey, girl, sip it.
Hey, girl, sip it.
Hey, boy, chug it.
Yeah, please. Girls have to sip, boys chug.
But yeah, I thought it was delicious. You could barely tell there was alcohol in there. Yeah. I could have like 7 of those and be like, whoops.
Yeah, that was it's a dangerous drink, but worked. Yeah.
Wait 20 minutes after you pop that.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Before we get into this movie, we should probably talk about what happened in it.
What happened? All right, so here we go. The Singing Detective. Detective novelist Dan Dark is hospitalized due to the skin disease psoriasis and crippling psoriatic arthritis. Around doctors and nurses, he occasionally hallucinates them in choreographed musical numbers. They attempt to help Dark but are dismissed by Dark's anger and bitterness towards everyone. In an attempt to solve his mental issues, the doctors send him to psychiatrist Dr. Gibbon. The doctor suspects the thoughts behind these problems are in Dark's novel, The Secret Detective. That's not right. It's called The Singing Detective, right? I'm almost positive.
Probably.
Yeah, okay. Anyway,
that's what detective. The cover that I'm looking at on Wikipedia is him reading a book called The Secret Detective.
Okay, I'm going to assume this is a typo, which is about a nightclub singer / private eye hired by Mark Binney who takes on a strange case involving prostitutes and two mysterious men. He fantasizes about the book during these meetings with people from the real world acting as the fictional characters. After reading some pages, Gibbon thinks Dark may have a problem with women. That's why he gets paid the big bucks, guys! This leads to Dark flashing back to his childhood when his mother worked as a prostitute and had sex with several men at their home, including his father's business partner. People he encountered in his childhood act as characters in fantasies of his novels. His mother is a prostitute. His father's business partner is a rich guy, and two passengers he only once encountered on a bus are thugs. Despite his skin condition improving, his attitude worsens after learning a film studio is interested in purchasing the rights for The Singing Detective. Yeah, now it calls it The Singing Detective. He is informed of this by his wife, Nicola, who is also a prostitute in the book fantasies. He is paranoid that Nicola is trying to steal the work so she can make money, and that Gibbon was met by a whore trying to get into the situation.
Wait, you said he has a problem with women? I don't think I'm hearing
I know. You have to be a really good psychiatrist to see that. Additionally, the two thugs from the fantasies have entered the real world, planning to rebel against the author for making them stand around constantly instead of playing more important roles, like being officers of the federal government. I don't think that's entirely accurate, but okay.
No.
Eventually, however, Dark is mentally cured through a civil discussion with Gibbon about his childhood. He states his father didn't care about him.
Civil discussion.
Yeah, such a calm one. Due to being a, quote, pain in the ass to raise, and Dan was often alone in his room to read. His father also constantly beat up his wife and kid. Just as he is about to be released from the hospital, he has another hallucination where reality meets his novel fantasies. The two thugs quickly drag his hospital bed throughout the building and attempt to kill him, while he also imagines himself as the detective alongside other vaudeville women. It ends with the fictional detective shooting the real author. After this hallucination, he leaves the hospital with his wife.
And that's a film.
And that's The Singing Detective. Real quick, Robert Downey Jr. is Dan Dark. Robin Wright is Nicola / Nina / Blonde. Jeremy Northam is Mark Binney, or Finney, I guess. Katie Holmes is Nurse Mills, who was not mentioned in this synopsis because she doesn't really matter that much. Carla Gugino is Betty Dark, his mother, or a hooker. Adrian Brody is the first hood. John Polito is the second hood. Mel Gibson is Dr. Gibbon, the psychiatrist. And then you've got, like, Saul Rubinek as a doctor, Alfre Woodard as a doctor, Amy Aquino as a nurse. Basically, all those people who don't really matter that much.
Half the women in the film also play whores.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is like a Frank Miller Batman story where every woman has been wildly reconceived to be a prostitute.
Yes.
It's so radical.
Yeah, it's really just about how this really cool guy keeps being assailed by a bunch of dumb prostitutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about...
Yeah, let's go to the hop.
Yeah, let's go to the hop. So this is a movie. It's 109 minutes long.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's adapted from a BBC series that is 6 episodes that run like kind of like over an hour. Mm-hmm. Not like, it's like an hour, but it's like, it's a chunky hour.
Yeah, yeah. It's a flabby hour.
Yeah. It's like a very well-regarded series.
Right? Yeah, it's definitely like incredibly, like I think that was like listed like number 2 in Michael Gambon's obituary.
Yeah, like, I mean like that is, I feel like, right, Harry Potter is like the thing that pop culture remembers him for, but this, I think like Singing Detective is the like the acting role that people are like, oh.
Dennis Potter, the author, suffers from the condition that the character suffers from in the
story.
Both of the stories.
Psoriasis and then also psoriatic arthritis.
I suppose. I'm not sure the details of some of it, because I know that like in this BBC series they understated how it affected Michael Gambon, because Dennis Potter's like skin would crack and bleed a lot.
Yeah, just in real life it was much worse than it's actually depicted. Yes.
Wow.
So it's actually better than what it.
Yeah. Is. So it sounds like fucking hell. Yeah,
I'm not sure about, definitely like the makeup on Robert Downey Jr.'s looks worse.
Yeah.
Looks like it's not like bad makeup, but like looks like the condition is way worse than Michael Gambon.
He has a lot of open oozing sores.
Yes. So I'm not sure if they changed that deliberately or if that was just makeup decisions.
Right. It might just be one of those things where it's like, we have movie budget versus TV, even though it's $8 million, we still have more money to play with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, BBC also would not have been nearly $8 million.
Love the BBC, but they did not have that kind of money.
For that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things that had to like change. I had seen the TV show I've seen this movie when I was a kid, probably in one of my, again, I liked Robert Downey Jr. in something, and then I looked up on IMDb, which was in its like infancy at the time, and would like find other movies, and I just randomly, I would go to the movie store and be like, do you have this one? And they did, and I would rent it. So I walked into The Singing Detective like totally blind, thinking like, oh, there's like a detective on the cover, and nope. That happened a lot when I was a kid, and that's kind of how I saw a lot of these weird-ass movies. It got exposed to a lot of things I wouldn't get exposed to otherwise. So it overall was a positive experience, but I remember being a little blindsided, but like, oh, this is actually like a really crazy kind of dark film.
Right, this is much weirder than you might think, which I think speaks to, again, the trailer that we watched for this movie, where it becomes very clear that Paramount's marketing team...
Yeah, the trailer
makes
like,
it look like it's a comedy, it's definitely not that.
Yeah, 100% not.
That happens still, though. That
no, it definitely does, but I can only imagine that if you saw this trailer and were sold on the idea of like, oh, it's like sort of a postmodern meta detective comedy noir, and then you show up to the theater and watch it, like, I feel like you... would be understandably asking for your money back.
Some of those elements are in there. It is postmodern. It is newer-ish.
I suppose it's postmodern. I mean, but it's certainly not as silly as the trailer makes it out to be. It is at times kind of darkly comic.
Right.
But it's not haha.
No, it's not like
there's literally a record scratch in that trailer.
Yeah, and it's not like a zany thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, later on I did see the TV show again in the less distant past, and I try, like, it's kind of hard to find. I think you can find it if you like Google individual episodes on YouTube, but maybe not all of them, but then also then you have to otherwise pay for it or buy it or something.
I meant to look if it was on archive.org or something. I feel like it would be.
I was able to watch episode 1 and some of episode 6, and I was rereading the summary just to like refresh my memory. What I was struck by watching episode 1 last night was like how most of this is in the movie. A lot of it's not in the movie because there's just a lot more to do in the series. There's 6 episodes. There's whole characters and arcs and like there's more depth to everyone because there can be. But a lot of, like, the core key scenes are, like, mostly intact. As an example, it's from episode 1 alone. The scene of the doctors coming in and, like, it sort of descending into, like, a sort of surreal sequence where there are sort of, like, a bunch of doctors. And they're sort of, like, mindlessly, and they're not mindlessly, but, like, kind of, like, callously talking about
him. Right, they're like, condition. Talking about him, though he's there, kind of. And, like, but they're not really talking to him.
Yeah, right? And I've had this experience.
Right.
Like, I've been in the hospital and like had a doctor, but it was like it wasn't like a bunch of, it was like one doctor and like a bunch of just like 5 students
come. Right, I mean that's usually that is right, it's like it's not just like one doctor, it's like a bunch of people come and surround you
and they just
like
surround your bed and like they're all talking about like, and it is mostly the one doctor in most cases that's just like sort of asking you, and you've never seen this doctor before. You've been treated by nurses, so you're like, who the fuck are you, and what is your responsibility towards me? I don't know. But they are just, like, doing that around the bed and like, going over his medical history, etc. And they're sort of rattling off drug names and stuff and, like, symptoms. And then it sort of descends into, like, a song. In the series, it makes more sense because it's, like...
Dem bones. Yeah, I forget what it's called,
Versus, like, it's the just hop. The hop.
Right, which is just, like, a 50s... rock song about let's dance and have fun,
yeah,
versus Dem Bones, which is about your skeleton, which makes some level of sense,
right,
when doctors are talking about your body, for you to then imagine
yeah.
skeletons.
It would also be, if there was more comedic intent in this movie, I think a more comedic or fun choice.
Yeah, and the thing also I would say about that first fantasy scene that you see is it's in the movie, it's kind of just sort of a manic dance number, uh-huh. where it's just like people kind of swing each other around and spinning on mm-hmm. hospital beds. When you see the Dem Bones number in the series, at one point a nurse is using a skeleton as a xylophone, playing yeah. on skulls. It's goofy and surreal,
it's
in like
dark,
a fun way.
Yeah, it's goofy and surreal, but it fits like the song. It's
yes.
almost like a dark, isn't like literally dark lit, almost like voodoo-esque, like
yeah.
kind of setup where there's mm-hmm. just like
right.
Yeah.
And you have like a line of sexy nurses like dancing
yeah.
across in front of them. And it's strange in a very surreal, interesting way. Whereas in the movie, it's just kind of
generic.
Manic and frantic.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it already it immediately cuts to showing like Detective Dan Dark singing the song as well.
Yes.
And
yes. Which is strange, but yes.
Yeah. That was the one moment during the movie that it almost felt like shock treatment to me. Especially when the walls come
the
away.
Walls come
yeah.
away. And you're almost seeing this like weird backstage space.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the lights
yeah.
are on and they're still kind of doing their dance.
Yeah,
that felt very shock treatment.
Yeah, no,
to
that
yeah.
does. Yes, yes.
But yeah, that scene is almost exactly in it. The speeches,
yeah.
a lot of the speeches there. Like again, having seen it so close to seeing the movie again today was like a really good choice in the end, because I was able to be like, that line's exactly the same. All of this writing, it's like we just cut it and pasted
right.
it in.
It's just a lot of pruning of the series to
yeah.
make into a movie.
It's a lot of pruning, and then it really is like due to the compression. Changing some stuff. Like, I'm trying to think of what's actually added.
Do you feel like it made less sense in the movie?
Yeah.
Like, did it hang together better on the show? Did
yeah.
it make more sense?
I mean,
there?
It would have, right? Like,
you have 6 hours.
You
versus...
had more time to establish characters and great. I mean, this is kind of like the story of, like, the character. His name is Philip Marlowe in the series.
Which I also find interesting that this is going to be a recurring thing throughout this episode where I just want to ask Dennis Potter, why did you do this
right.
whenever
he
you were writing this movie?
About it in the series.
Uh-huh.
He's explaining that his name is Philip Marlowe to a nurse who doesn't really know who Philip Marlowe
right.
is. And is like, oh, my mother named it. She's like, oh, I'm an author or whatever. I write these books. My mother named me that. Can you believe that she did that?
Uh-huh.
It's like a joke. So
right,
like,
right, right.
It's like referred to in the...
Text
yeah.
that
yeah.
his name is a wink wink
to
detective.
Philip Marlowe, the fictional detective.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas Dan Dark is just
it just sounds like
sort of
a superhero or Donnie
yeah.
Darko
yeah,
or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
It does. The uncle to Donnie Darko.
Yes.
It is that, and the compression, because the story is basically like that character's journey to recovery, it makes a lot less sense in the movie because much more context and character growth is cut out, and
mm-hmm.
just like character just showing who this person is. You guys were saying a lot for this movie how unlikable he is,
mm-hmm.
and he is meant to be like an asshole, but like you're supposed to kind of understand more why, and like he is still an asshole in the series, but he is also humanized with a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I
guess they just didn't have time for it in the movie.
Yeah, as an example, in episode one, there is an arc. In the series, he is in, like, a big-ass ward full of people. There's, like, I don't know, 10,
mm-hmm.
8 to 10 beds, maybe, and as many people. There's one that's his neighbor in episode one, who's this, like, Pakistani character, Ali. He's kind of an asshole in, like, a lot of, again, casually racist 80s ways towards
mm-hmm.
Ali, but also in a way that, like, it's weirdly... Not wholly, like, unironic. There's, like, a level... Like, he doesn't... Like, Ali is, like, this... He's a heart patient, and he's, like, kind of this more optimistic, but kind of, like, mischievous and kind of, like, cheeky character. It's, like, a weird stark contrast to this nihilistic, depressed asshole who's
right.
next to him.
Sounds like a good foil.
And he doesn't, he doesn't mind, like, they kind of jibe at each other, like, he doesn't really give a shit about whatever the fuck, you know, nonsense he's shouting
mm-hmm.
at him. And he sends it back. And, like, they kind of use it at one point because he convinces Ali to, like, get him his cigarette so that he can have a cigarette. And he's not supposed to get out of bed. So if he does, Ali does it, which he's not supposed to do because he's supposed to stay in bed. And then the doctor catches him out of bed and comes back and is like, Philip Marlowe is like, oh, I made him do that. I made him get out of bed, put him to work or whatever. Like, he says some, like, casually racist thing to, like, sort of have him take
yeah,
the fall
right.
instead of Ali for getting out of bed. And then towards the end of that episode, Ollie's, like, offering, they're, like, talking and Ollie's, like, offering him a candy. He's like, well, each have one. It'll be fine. Like, because he's having a shitty day. Like, because he's having a shitty life, basically.
Yeah.
And while he's, like, reaching over, he has a heart attack and dies. Because Philip Marlowe's, like, yelling, screaming for the nurse. And they come
wow.
in, they can't revive him or whatever. Like, later on, contextually, he's just like you feel that Marlowe's just kind of like a wreck, kind of like in tears, and they just sort of assume that he's like in pain or whatever. But it's like very clearly like he's grieving this guy. Right. He's like sad. So there's like a lot
that's
of stuff.
That sounds like a hugely humanizing moment.
The way that he is an asshole is more, as portrayed by Michael Gambon, does kind of lean more into like a at the end of his tether depressed thing. He is still like incredibly vitriolic. A lot of the things that Dandark says are word for word what, like that whole thing about fair. Like depopulation by infanticide, blah, blah, blah. Like, why should the queers have AIDS? Let's all have AIDS or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, that's exactly the same speech. Why should the queers be special? Let's give AIDS to everyone or whatever. So he still is all of that, but he also will, like, be, like, you'll see him just, like, in sort of hysterics and tears a lot of the time from, like, mm-hmm. the pain and the suffering.
And, I mean, I think one thing I want to sort of just reiterate real quick. I like that as a concept, having not seen the full miniseries.
Yeah.
Because I do think that that is one of those things that makes a character likable. But the other thing I want to throw out is a character need not be likable, of course, to be interesting. Mm-hmm. But yeah. you have to be interesting to be interesting, which I think is the fault of this one here. It's kind of the double whammy where this character is both not likable and not interesting enough for me to care mm-hmm. about what happens to them.
And it sounds like maybe the unlikability was better balanced on the TV show where they had a lot more time and space to like make him a person.
Yeah. Right, and the series also seems to go a little bit more into what makes this man tick beyond some basic bitch Freudian mommy issues. Right.
Beyond,
my mom had sex.
My mom had to be a sex worker.
Yeah.
So I'm angry at her, and therefore all women.
I'm angry at all women, and all women are prostitutes, yes.
Yeah, he does actually, I mean, it was weird that I was saying, like, why didn't they go into some of the stuff the series goes into with, like, his own guilt, which I'll expound on, we can expound on later, I think that's the thing to unpack separately.
Mm-hmm.
But he does have a line where he's talking about his mom having committed suicide, and he says out loud to Dr. Gibbon, like, I didn't kill my mom.
Yeah.
As if he has to, like, affirm that to himself.
Right.
So it's almost like Dennis Potter or somebody who was making the screenplay was like, that's a good thought, right? Like, that's a good idea that he might feel responsible for that because the reason why his mom had to do all that was to support him.
Right.
But we don't touch on it again.
No, yeah.
I don't know if the Wikipedia movie summary really covers this. I just want to cover our bases for the topic here. Like, the story within a story is kind of centered on...
Bless you,
this baby. Idea that like, all of the women in his life are like betraying him or like whores.
Or leading him on or manipulating him.
He's basically like villainizing other people in his life in both versions.
Right.
But there is a character in both who features a bit less in the movie called like Finny.
Finny, yeah.
Depending on
Who this character
Finny.
Is. Yes.
Finny seemed to be the real life version.
Well, in this movie, I'm not sure. Like,
I think he might be real in this movie, which I'm not sure that he, the adult version.
Yeah,
okay.
But like in the series, it's really like more like, yes, his mom committed adultery, but he kind of places blame in the series more on this guy that she committed adultery with, Mark Binney. And then later on, it's kind of revealed that Mark Binney probably isn't a real person, or was, but it's not an old adult who had sex with his mom, but it's in fact like a student that he went to school with,
mm-hmm.
that he got in trouble, the main Philip Marlowe, he framed for the teacher for doing something bad. And then like that kid ended up in like in an asylum eventually, which like, you know, that probably wasn't the only thing that put him in an asylum.
Right. Correct, but it's easy enough as a child to take blame for that.
So they imply that, like, a lot of the reasons why he's vilifying this Binney character in the books is because of his own guilt, where he has to, like, come up with a reason for why that's the case. Whereas they kind of got rid of that in the movie, and Binney might also have actually been a character that fucked his mom as a kid.
Right, it's it's very difficult to tell if this is a real person in this movie. Like, I assume, my takeaway from watching this is that, yes, indeed, his dad had a partner named Binney who had an affair with his mom, and that was the beginning of the end for their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But also we find out that his dad was, like, abusive or some shit, like, too, which is super weird given that his dad's barely a character in this movie. But anyway, so, like, I have to assume that there is indeed a real life Binney, but then you also have the scenes where it's the same actor, Jeremy Northam, playing, I think that's Finny, right?
The producer,
Who's playing a producer who seems to be an imaginary character.
Yes.
Who Robert Downey Jr. believes is fucking his wife.
And
is also trying to get the rights to his novel so that he can make a movie out of it. And this will screw Robert Downey Jr. out of money somehow.
Yeah.
Well, and it's every time we see Finny show up, the executive, Robin Wright is always like his willing participant in some kind of conspiracy to like snow Robert Downey
Jr. to like defraud him of money. And so it is interesting that the movie sees fit to remove that entire layer, you know?
In the series there's also a Finny who's fucking his actual wife as well.
Okay.
So there's three Finnies in the series, and there's two in the movie.
It didn't seem like in the movie it seemed like his wife wasn't cheating on him.
No.
Yeah, I think, my takeaway from just this movie, is that his wife is indeed not having an affair.
Correct.
And that she is faithful, but she's annoyed, understandably annoyed with him, but she's not having an affair. Whereas, I guess, in the series, she is having an affair, apparently.
I don't think she is.
Oh, okay. So he's also imagining this.
Yes.
Okay. So the thing that's really kind of taken out of the movie that's present in the series is the concept of him framing this student for a crime where he pooped on a desk. And in the movie, that is not present at all. So in the movie, it really basically just boils down to, as I said, some basic bitch Freudian bullshit where it's just, I saw mommy fucking a man and that that screwed up all women for me. Whereas in the series, it's like, you kind of think that at first, but then it also becomes clear that no, there's actually something below that. Mm-hmm. There's like a deeper thing that happened that sort of made up or informed or mutated this thing that he saw as a child, and that explains that. I think it takes something that feels very rote and makes it a little more interesting just because there is something more to it. Whereas in the movie, it's just kind of like, it
stays rote.
Oh, you hate women? Well, your mom was a prostitute.
And it especially ends up feeling unsatisfying as a motivation for his bitterness and his behavior when, like, you can pretty clearly tell she's not doing anything wrong.
Right. I mean, well,
she's trying to help him. And I understand that it's a part of the complication of how he's feeling and how he is. He's lashing out at people kind of regardless. That is a kind of another impediment to being able to access him as a character, because you're just like, no, can you shut the fuck up for like 2 seconds? She's just trying to help you.
Well, what I was going to say is also that it feels like the movie wants there to be some sort of interesting unpacking of who this character is. But it's very easy to determine from the get-go. One, this guy has issues with women. And you see also very early on that his mom seems to be having sex with some random guy. You don't necessarily know who it is, but you see him seeing her having sex with some guy.
Played by Jeremy Northam.
Played by Jeremy Northam. There's not even a mystery to like figure out like what is it that happened in this guy's life that made him this way. You get it about 30 minutes into the movie, and it's just sort of a long slog from there on where Mel Gibson is working with him trying to make him understand why he thinks all women are prostitutes. We get it. We get why he thinks all women are prostitutes. He's fucked up and he has mommy issues.
Yeah. And they needed to go deeper just because otherwise then we've already reached the conclusion point and the movie's well not over.
Right. And I mean, it's like, that's also, to be fair, as I said, that's some basic bitch shit and it's not interesting in itself either. So even if that was a revelation that came out at the end of Act 2, it would still be unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. But as it is now, it's unsatisfying and you still have 80 minutes left for the movie.
Yes.
I think it's the compression of it, right? Like,
yes.
They cut out some stuff. They change, I will say, like, a lot of, I mean, they kind of had to. This is where I think a lot of the adaptation came in. A lot of the story within a story is different in a couple ways. The series takes place in a different era, and also it's in England. So it's wartime England that the noir
World War II
takes place in.
Sure.
World War II,
yes.
The Blitz.
Yeah, the Blitz.
So, like, it's a very...
The Blitz.
It's a very different setting for, like, the noir. And also, like, not a lot really gets figured out in that. It's kind of used more as a device than, like, a second plot. Whereas Dan Dark, the detective in the movie, kind of, like, solves a case.
There is a case that they're trying to make happen in the movie, which I think is a mistake.
I do as well.
Because, again, one, it's not that interesting, and two, we're just spending so much time trying to work this thing out when you could be doing anything else.
Well, whereas it sounds like the show is actually using that to support the main narrative of, like, investigating this person, understanding who they are, healing them.
Yeah.
And the noir stuff is used as a vehicle to do that. I think at times there's, like, thematic crossover in the film's noir interludes, but by making it a real mystery to solve, I don't know, that almost takes its focus away from supporting the main plot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of imply in both versions with very different levels of success, like the idea that he's either A, sort of like writing in his head this story, but also B, possibly just like hallucinating because he's kind of just fucking...
He's been in a hospital, and he's by himself.
Yeah. He's in pain a lot, and that, you know, probably leads to some, you know, wacky, loopy brain times. Right. And there's, like, they even imply, I think in episode one, that he, like, doesn't, they're like, oh, you're talking today. And he is like, is that why they think I'm not all there? He's like, doesn't remember the fact that he didn't speak at all yesterday. Like, he was in some sort of fugue state without realizing it. So it is kind of implied that maybe he is just, like, having a trip sometimes in his brain. And this is what happens. It kind of, this story just plays out over and over again. But yeah, they try to make it more cohesive in the movie. I don't know why. It doesn't really feel that cohesive, but it definitely has more of a forward progression.
I couldn't really even tell you what the mystery really was.
I agree with you. I can't really. I find the mystery that's taking place in this, I find it to be very boring and I don't care about it. I almost wish it were, like in the series, just a means of exploring this character versus something that we're trying to work out. Because every time we cut back to the mystery and they try to throw that plot around a little bit more, I kind of just tune out, honestly. Right.
Yeah, I think those are the three ways that it's very different. And yeah, the fact that it's longer, but there's just, first of all, there's so many more characters.
Yeah.
Like Ali, there's like all these other, there's this like British guy in the ward who's like, whenever he's talking to the nurse or asking for something, he's like, I say, could I? And then when she walks away, he's like, what a bitch. Just like the worst guy. And he's sitting next to this guy who's like much younger and who just has to like kind of, he's always reading a magazine and he's just put up with this guy the whole time. And he's like, he said you were a bitch. There's just a lot more. And there's like the nurses, which again, I think they tried to copy types here where there's like sort of severe head nurse type.
And that was the Amy Aquino in this
one?
Yeah. And then there's also like the...
And Katie Holmes, like the young pretty nurse. Like
sort of, the sort of younger empathetic nurse.
Yeah.
So there's like similar types on display there, but they just have more time to grow. And
Stands in the movie, Katie Holmes does almost nothing. She makes him come by rubbing lotion on his body when she's trying to sort of like help him with his sores. And aside from that, she's really not there all that much. This is a character who could be removed if, again, probably not for the fact that this was a character in the TV show who mattered a little bit more. And it was just sort of like, well, I want to put her in somehow, in some capacity.
Yeah. So yeah, it's hard. I don't know. I don't know how to... we'll talk, I guess, later on in this podcast about how to do better. It's tough.
Like, honestly, going back to my whole I want to ask why sort of thing, I really just wanted to, like, why did he want to make this into a movie? That's kind of my biggest question. It feels like he did this before. He did it very well. Mm-hmm. Everyone seemed to love it. Everyone said it was good. Why did he want to turn it into a movie? Is it just a question of the series hasn't run in America? If I want Americans to know about this, it has to be a movie, and that's what we're going to do. I know that from when I was looking online, he also did the series Pennies from Heaven, which was adapted into a movie, the Steve Martin Bernadette Peters movie, and he was involved with that as a screenwriter, but he apparently did not like the final product and did not have a good time. So was this a preemptive, if someone's going to turn this into a movie, I want to be the one who does it. So this is inevitable, so it must be me who writes the screenplay in order to have some level of protection over it. So I don't know if it's that either. I truly just want to know, what were you hoping to accomplish with this? You didn't accomplish.
She was enthusiastic about it.
I mean, that's what I've gathered. Like, he seems to like it. Again, from everything I can tell, this is his screenplay. This is what he wrote, and it was not rewritten. It might have been trimmed or something like that, but it's not like someone did another pass on it. I have to assume, watching this movie, this is more or less what we had on paper.
I liked Pennies from Heaven better than this.
Oh yeah, I did too. I watched Pennies from Heaven as like a homework thing this week, just because I'd never seen it before.
It's a good movie,
and I think Pennies from Heaven works in every way that this does not.
Yeah.
I mean, you were, again, Chris, a lot of times you were like talking about the writing and you didn't agree with the writing, and I was like, it's the same writing.
So maybe what I'm disagreeing, I mean, I haven't seen the show, so I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I would disagree.
But I'm not disagreeing with your assessment. I think it's just like,
as presented in this, it was hard.
I'm finding it hard to sort of pinpoint. I think it's like a little bit of a perfect storm where like there are, the compression hurts understanding of the character. I think that I don't want to criticize anyone's performance because I think that everyone mostly did really well. Mm-hmm. I think that the choices for casting were maybe off in some ways.
Yes.
Yeah, which is something we'll get into when we talk about that, but I agree with you there.
Is there an element in here just the cultural difference? Does all of this hit our ears better if these are British people?
I don't know that it necessarily does. I think it still could. I think direction is a huge part of it, which is something we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But I think for me, a lot of the failures of this movie come down to the way it's being told.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the style and the direction, because that's the big part of this movie.
Here's the thing, too. This is kicking off our summer of unhinged musicals.
Yeah.
This is kind of barely a musical. And I'm not saying that as criticism to you for suggesting it, Lee.
Yeah.
But I'm saying this in the sense that, like, I don't know that I would consider this a musical.
I mostly just wanted us to watch The Singing Detective.
Yeah,
it's a Patchett movie.
Yeah.
It is. And it is. There are musical interludes.
Yeah, there are. But it's one of, so the gimmick, I guess, that Dennis Potter has that he used in this and Pennies from Heaven and something, Lipstick on Your Collar, whatever the fuck it was called, I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
But the idea was that there would be surreal sequences where characters would lip sync to pop standards, basically. And I was really just my biggest takeaway from this was something I knew he did, but I had never seen it before. And my takeaway after watching this specific movie was just, why is this the thing that you want to do? So I went on a little bit of like a Google hole trying to figure out precisely, because again, the problem is this guy is dead, and this is one of those things where it's like he was writing a lot in the 80s where a lot of interviews that he may have done aren't necessarily online, so it's hard to like track down, you know, from the horse's mouth from the sky.
And no one can just come up to him today and be like, right. What were you thinking?
I'll pull out my Ouija board. So there was an interview he did on WNYU in 1981 about the movie version of Pennies from Heaven. An interview by Will Friedwald, which I don't know who that is, but he did the interview, which I found online. Will Friedwald says, sometimes when you're listening to a singer, a popular singer, you begin to feel that you are singing it. And when you sing along with a performer, you begin to feel that you are that performer. And Dennis Potter said, well, I think it's what we do physically. Sometimes you want to twitch your foot or click your finger, and it's a short step from that to identifying even more closely with a singer. Like if you're in the bathtub and the resonance of the tiles is around you or whatever, you are Bing Crosby or you are Sinatra or whatever. The characters in Pennies from Heaven lip sync our mind to actual recordings of the time so that it is directly at you. That music is coming out at you very directly. And this means they're much more closely related, more authentically related to the nature of the way that we do dream about songs and being the singer of songs and so on. And you are plunged much more quickly into the nature of the character's imagination than you would be if you simply recreated them or if it was the actor singing. There was another Salon.com had an interview of this movie where the critic Charles Taylor suggested Potter may have been suggesting the way we lose ourselves in popular culture, but the stronger impression was of people finding their voice, of pop songs allowing them the highest, clearest expression of what was inside them.
Sure.
So I think it's mostly that. My takeaway basically from reading this and watching the movie is that it has something to do with the disconnect between the relics of the past and your reality. From what I can tell, Dennis Potter really does not like nostalgia, so it doesn't seem like it's just a simple nostalgia grab. He seemed to hate nostalgia before it was cool to hate nostalgia. And the songs, you know, as we said, obviously, in the TV series, they're all from the 1930s as opposed to the 50s, and they're all lip-synced. And apparently in the show, Lee, I don't know this, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I only found one source saying this, where it says that in the TV show, Philip Marlowe's father used to do this at a local pub. Do you know any idea if that's a thing in the show?
I don't remember.
Okay, so I can't say for 100% certainty that that is a thing that happened or not.
Interesting.
The significance comes from contrasting innocent songs from that time with the harsh realities of actual life, which is a huge thing in Pennies from Heaven.
It absolutely is.
But the thing is also, too, if indeed this is a thing that his father did when he was a kid, and that is kind of the quote-unquote justification for why characters are doing this.
We need to see that.
I would have loved to have seen this. When I watched Pennies from Heaven, to me it made perfect sense that the characters were lip-syncing, because it was very much Steve Martin's character kind of clinging to the fictional, happy reality that this song suggests are true. You know, like, every time it rains pennies from heaven while the Great Depression is going on.
Exactly.
So it's like, whenever you cut to this sort of weird fantasy where he's lip-syncing along with the song, it's because this character wants that desperately to be true.
Yeah.
For the singing detective in the movie, at least, I don't have a sense of why this is happening, aside from the fact that it's sort of surreal and weird.
And because, for the most part, the songs don't have a lot of connection to what scene they're in, even if you could reach for some kind of thematic resonance, which I think occasionally is sort of there in a superficial level, but it just seemed like they were just picking recognizable songs from the 40s and 50s and having people lip sync them. And wouldn't that be weird if that happened in the middle of a hospital room? Wouldn't that be weird? You know, yada, yada, yada. It's not like the songs have anything to do with what's going on.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's also, as we talked about before, the inherent pitfall of any jukebox musical, where it's like you have to really work to try and find a song that fits the plot or shows character or something like that. Yeah. And I think this movie really kind of does a bad job of choosing songs that sort of fit into that. I think the closest it comes really is when they lip sync to Poison Ivy, just because that's both about, one, a dangerous slutty woman, and two, skin's itchy.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's kind of the closest that I get to really getting something that kind of hits on another level.
Right.
Yeah.
Everything else is just sort of there.
Again, all the song choices are different.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, right. The thing too is, obviously, Lee, as you said, this was this series being set in World War II England.
Yeah.
The songs are from the 40s here, because I don't know why. The movie is ostensibly set in the 80s. Robert Downey Jr. as a kid would have been like a child in the 50s, so you're getting songs from the 50s, from like sort of the early rock and roll era.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why the movie does songs from the 50s, I guess. I don't know why the movie just didn't make the choice to set it in, I don't know, like the 70s or 60s and still have it be those World War II era songs. Again, why this choice?
Right.
Why? It's very strange to me, this whole like lip syncing thing, and I don't think it's bad. It's just that I kept watching this movie wanting to have an answer for why it was doing this. Even if it was literally something as dumb as his mother would loudly play 50s rock songs while she was having sex with men so that he wasn't overhearing them. It's like, again, that's dumb, but it's something.
It would be something.
You know?
Or like the dad thing in the pub, if that was true.
Right, yeah. So it's just like, Pennies from Heaven seems to have a logic to it that this movie does not. And that's kind of what I think that's what drove me a little nuts when I first watched this. I knew that that was a gimmick, but I kept thinking it would make more sense. And again, when I watched a little bit of the series, it worked better.
Yeah.
Part of it was direction, definitely, but part of it also was song choice.
Yeah. There's some other stuff here. I want to talk about the sets in this movie.
Yes, please.
They're,
and the lighting.
They're very stagey. Everything's very stagey.
Everything is very stagey.
Very stagey.
It's a question. It's one of those like questions, the eternal question of like, is it cheap or is it stylized? You know,
I think it's both.
I think it's trying. Yeah.
I think it's a good. I think mostly it's a good choice.
Yes.
I, there are times I think when it works very well. Like we said in the first
Brechtian.
Time.
Brechtian.
Yeah. Bring out a college.
It is.
Word.
Yes. Oh my. Oh sir.
It's like
yes. It is Brechtian.
It's darkness around the
right.
edges.
Yes.
Right.
You're. Really only seeing the parts
showing
you need to see.
Stage.
And I think,
yeah,
like, Lee, you had said when we, the first time where we have that first sex scene in the beginning of the movie, where it looks like it's just kind of a couch. It's
in a
blackness.
Yeah,
yeah,
and
it's
then,
a
like,
black
the bathroom
void.
Door opens.
And then, yeah, then all of a sudden, like, you see the light underneath the door. So, like, a bar of light shows at the bottom, and then the door opens, and
yeah.
It's like the door opens from nowhere.
It's a cool visual.
Yeah, and it is kind of, I think you had said, Lee, it almost feels like it's one of those visual things of, like, the writer doesn't know what the room looks
yes.
like, so it's being generated as he
yeah.
has to, oh, I need a door.
As
a door is here now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did like that. There are other times I think when we go back to the room where it still continues to feel like a play or something, mm-hmm. where it feels like a very flat one single wall.
Yeah, well, I think it's because it's only ever seen from one angle usually.
Pretty much.
Where,
well,
like,
you see, yeah, you see, because you do see Robert Downey Jr. look at the closet when he goes to
yeah.
hide in the closet, but for the most part, you're kind of just seeing head on
yes.
of a couch and a door next to it.
Yeah, and like bits like the when they go into the hop, they're in a hospital room, and then
yes.
the walls just open up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like soundstage.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they go through the into like a stage area.
Yes.
Which I do kind of like that as a choice a little bit.
Yeah.
I find it exciting sometimes when a show or a movie will just kind of randomly
break the walls, literally break the walls.
Literally
yeah.
break the walls, yeah.
yeah.
Like the Julio Torres series on HBO last year, Phantasmas, did that a lot, and it was really fun.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like how, like, it's a choice in a similar way that, like, the reason I like the Music Man movie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Very
lights,
stagey.
Lights literally come down.
Right, they'll literally have, like, a spotlight show.
Yeah.
Like, someone will be sitting on their porch, and then the spotlight is on them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even sometimes, like, on the other half of the screen, there'll be someone in a different
yeah,
location with the spotlight
as if,
on
like,
them too.
The stagehands are like rolling in the set.
Right,
piece.
Right, yeah, no, it
the
literally
porch
yeah,
set piece.
Right, it literally looks like how it would be on stage if you just had two people on opposite ends of the stage
yeah.
with like minimal sets behind them.
Very charming.
Yeah,
yeah, it's, that's the kind of thing I like. I think it's a good choice.
Yeah, I don't think it's inherently bad. I think
it can
read
it
can, as stagey
can, yeah.
or lazy, but I don't think it's always bad.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, that was one of the first, like, movie musicals I think I saw,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, this is what they're like, I guess.
That's such a big impression.
Yeah. It, well, yeah, I guess it was pretty formative, so it just taught me, maybe that's why I'm able to, like...
That's why you accept the staginess.
I was just like, I guess it's what you get.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a musical, so they had to keep it, like, stage-like or
yeah.
something. Some of those choices are interesting. The TV show, it can't kind of do a lot of the same stuff because it is made for TV.
Right.
So it kind of is a lot more sort of just, like, cuts to, like, and now we do this, and, like,
right.
the song. Like, it kind of, like, he's talking to the doctor, it cuts to his face, and then it cuts back to the doctor. Now they're in a voodoo weird skeleton...
Right.
This setting, and it just starts the song.
Right. And then, like, when the song is over, they're literally, like, raising a curtain up behind
yes.
them, and then they're just, like, back in the beginning as it was again.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool.
Again, a little more made for TV, a little less transitionary stuff
yeah.
that happens.
I feel like I have to say, I almost kind of like that in the series more than I think I do here, where it doesn't feel like there is as much of a, either intentionally or due to budget in this series, it doesn't feel like they're doing things like lighting or just film techniques to
yeah.
sort of differentiate, like, the hospital from the fantasy. See, you know, like
yeah.
it all feels kind of the same.
The lighting, like, certainly, like, during like the bones thing, the lighting gets darker.
Right? No,
it does
get darker, but it's a little less. It's certainly not as drastic as
yeah.
it is in the movie.
What doesn't happen is the really washed out lighting in the hospital.
Yeah, no, the hospital
yeah.
is a lot. Of, yeah, a lot of, it's
Do
again.
You know what? I think it's like a '90s. Thing.
It might be.
I mean, it also, like, it feels like it's just the easiest choice you could possibly make
it's
to make sure the audience
so,
isn't confused.
It's
yeah.
so washed
what
out.
We
it's
talking?
Distracting at times.
There was another movie we're talking about that had the really washed out lighting, and I can't remember.
I don't remember.
Wicked? Had really washed out lighting.
No,
it was
like a movie
yeah.
for the pod, where it was like just overexposed almost.
Right, yeah, I mean, that's how it is here. It's to the
yeah.
point that, like, it's almost unpleasant for me to look at because
yeah.
it's so bright.
But in any
all
case, yeah, it's
kind of
bad
me. I can't remember which one that
yeah.
was.
Yeah, it was. We've talked about that being an issue for another movie.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of. Is anything else we want to touch on? The aesthetics, the styles?
Briefly, for direction, I want to say that this was directed by Keith Gordon, who I know more as an actor than I did as a director. I didn't know he directed the movie version of The Chocolate War, which I saw years ago. But don't remember super well. And it seems like after this movie, he kind of was not allowed to be a movie director anymore.
So he went to
kind of
movie jail?
He went to TV. He's directed, because Faith actually said that she met him because he directed an episode of The Leftovers
oh,
or something.
Wow.
And, like, I'm sure he's a very nice guy. I've liked him as an actor in things. I think his direction here is kind of abysmal.
Yeah.
I think he was a terrible choice to make this movie. I don't know how. It literally seemed, from what I gathered online, I know that he knew Robert Downey Jr. because they did a movie together at one point. So I literally just, was it just that Robert Downey Jr. Maybe. Knew him and liked him and wanted to loop him into this as well? But I think the direction of this movie is terrible. I think that is my biggest problem with this movie. The way it tells the story visually is just so bad to me. I think certain times when we were having a discussion earlier, like, is this artistic or is it cheap? I think a lot of times for me, it reads more toward cheap because it's just not done very well. I wish I had like sort of more specific examples. I can't remember if I wrote something down here.
I don't know if it's him or the DP we have to blame, but the camera is very uninspired moves, uninspired photography in general.
Yeah.
Very Route One, very prosaic.
No, it is. And especially even like toward the end when the universes sort of start collapsing in on themselves, you just get a lot of, again, very washed out, very bright, very close up. Like, and it's just, I feel like this movie needed someone with a sense of style or even though it's not fully a musical, it needed someone who had a musical sensibility to itself.
It needed to be a heightening.
What if Bob Fosse made this movie? Like, despite the fact that he would have been dead at the time.
If possible, though, I think that would have been.
I feel like Bob Fosse would have, like, loved this sort of shit.
Did we bring up that David Lynch was on top?
Okay, I made that up, apparently.
Oh, you made that up.
I made that up?
Yeah, okay.
How did you make that up?
I don't know. I think it was my subconscious being like, what if David Lynch did this
instead? Well, because it's, so here's what it was. The perfect match.
No, it is. 100%. David Lynch would have been a much better choice.
He would have crushed
apparently,
this.
So what I was thinking of, what I had read online, at one point it was going to be Cronenberg.
Which, you know what? Cronenberg does other things.
I know. I know. I don't want to say like he just does like
body
horror.
Can you imagine how much grosser the psoriasis looks?
I was
going to
say
this is Cronenberg.
Oh, there is the psoriasis.
I don't want to know. Actually, I know. Stay at
home. Yeah. And apparently,
I'll give you Eastern Promises, but
he wanted Pacino to play.
Whoa!
Which,
I mean, I don't think
he's older.
No,
bad.
I don't
older.
Either.
That'd
I think
be a
it
good
could
idea.
Work. And the other option apparently at one point was Altman with Dustin Hoffman. Robert Altman
which,
with Dustin Hoffman.
I like Altman. I don't necessarily see him in this.
Right, it's one of those things where like I'm not entirely sure what Altman has done in the past that makes me feel like he would have been a good fit here, but like he's a smart enough director that I think it could have still been interesting.
Aside from having his usual like people talk over each other style, he does different kinds of movies.
No,
so
he does.
I could see that.
No, yeah, right. Again, this is not me saying that it would have been bad, just me saying that, like, I'm not sure what he's done previously that feels like it sort of would be like, oh, he did X, so this would have worked. But again, these are still two directors who have very distinct styles, who have very strong senses of how to tell a story visually, which Keith Gordon, I think, just doesn't.
Now,
and so, like, either of these would have been more interesting just by dint of the fact that the director was a more interesting choice.
You need a stronger POV for sure. I had the name in my head just now. Who is the director who did Phantom of the Paradise?
Oh, De Palma?
He would be kind of great.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, too. There are
he
so
would
many,
be kind
right.
of great with
There
this.
Are so many of these directors who sort of came into their own in the 70s and early 80s who I feel like would have been far more interesting choices. And maybe this is just the problem when you have an $8 million budget.
Maybe.
And, you know.
Okay.
What?
We talk about how we like the series more,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Do you want to know what the director of the series directed?
I feel like I looked this up. What?
The Core.
That's right. That's right. Right, I did look that up.
Oh, where we save the world by throwing nukes into
the center of the Earth. Yes.
I was like trying to, that's the first thing I'm doing. I was like, what else did he do? But he has done an absolute shit ton of TV. Holy shit, he directed some Hemlock Grove as well. He's a working man.
Oh, man.
Anyway. Let's talk about the cast.
Yeah, let's try and go through it kind of quick just as we're.
RDJ? Jr.
Listen, I think that the so this was an interesting. You saying this was during like it was.
This was his uninsurable phase.
His uninsurable phase.
Yes,
where you take the movie being made for $8 million.
Well, no. I mean, where it was only just that, like, Mel Gibson had to pay for his insurance policy for Robert Downey Jr. to be on this movie because he was not insurable.
Gotcha.
So Mel Gibson, like, paid for it.
Yeah, I think that it's a very different take on the character.
Yes.
And I think there's
and maybe that's why the name was changed, even. You know, maybe it's just to, like, really go out and say, like, this is a different story. But anyway.
I think that there's two things that affect why this it doesn't work as well for me. I don't think anything isn't the choices that – I think the choices that he makes are fine choices.
Yeah.
But I think making the character younger and having him go more angry, which is a choice, and I don't have a problem with that choice, but in the reduced time you have, you don't have as much time to humanize the character.
Yes. Nope. Yes.
So he just feels too mean and vitriolic and hateful.
Up until the end when he suddenly becomes nice.
Within the span of like 10 minutes, he seems to have a revelation.
Right. You have like the scene of him hiding in the closet, and then you have Dan Dark, the detective, shooting him, and then he becomes like nice again.
I guess the summary kind of covers it, but that is meant to sort of be a symbolic like, killing the toxic,
the bad parts of you, yes.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel earned at all in this movie.
Especially because then at the end, you immediately cut to Robin, Wright, and him, and they're, like, lovey again. Yes. And it's just like, are you
like,
really?
How did that happen?
Right, yeah, when did that exactly. happen?
But I think that, like, the acting work is fine.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you can't fault the writing. This is the same, this is pretty much the same writing. We changed some stuff, we made less of it, and that affects it, but yeah.
Right, I mean, well, the thing also you had said about age that I think is important to throw out there when we were talking about this earlier is the fact that Michael Gambon being older at the time implies that like he had a life kind of before his psoriasis really came and went to shit.
Yeah.
Whereas Robert Downey Jr. being in his early 30s, I think, in this movie, it feels like this man did not really live a life. This man turned 20, then psoriasis started flaring up, and he's been, you know, miserable for his entire
and I
life,
think
basically.
That maybe makes sense why there's more anger than despair.
It could.
But like where it doesn't make sense is it is the same writing. And the writing is from a person who has memories of maybe a time that wasn't so miserable all the time.
Yes.
And he's dealing with a lot of other characters who are both older than younger than him, and he is being very sort of condescending and superior and smug.
Yes.
And it's not like it's excusable, but it makes more sense coming from Michael Gambon than it does this little shit heel.
Yes, I agree.
Although, I mean, I think he does a pretty good job with handling a kind of difficult character.
Yeah.
He really brings the anger.
Yeah, no, I mean, like Lee said, I like what he's doing, but I do agree that he's kind of miscast.
Yeah.
It's a choice that doesn't quite, I think, work. We should probably talk about Mel Gibson.
I think does pretty good work in this movie.
It does pretty good work.
I mean, again, like I had said the first time I was watching this, it's one of those times when, like, an actor is like, I must become ugly to unlock my inner character actor.
Yeah.
And so Mel Gibson throws on a bald wig and is like, I'm a little nerdy psychiatrist.
And the glasses.
Yeah.
Kicking up his little feet.
Right, sitting on the desk, like, kicking his little feet like a kid. And it, like, I think it's fun. I think nothing that the psychiatrist is doing is probably ethical.
No. You were pointing out, like, why is he hitting...
He's grabbing him a lot.
He's grabbing him a lot, which is clearly hurting him. And
it's always like he grabs him, and Robert Downey Jr. is like, "Oh," he's like, "Oh, well, I'm sorry, boy, I forgot all that." So it's like it feels like he's doing this on purpose.
Yes,
because he's like sort of playing as like the it almost feels like the country lawyer, sort of like, "Oh, I'm just a simple psychiatrist. Can't remember not to touch my patients."
It felt like I think it described it as like the Good Will Hunting Robin Williams version of like pain retraining therapy, where he's like trying to force RDJ's character to realize that it doesn't hurt that bad or it doesn't hurt as much, but it's like, well, I'm gonna do that by constantly making him in pain.
It's one of those like this could work for a cinematic portrayal, but in real life, no, thank you.
Yeah, I unfortunately have to admit that Mel Gibson acts well in this movie.
I agree. I mean, Mel Gibson could be a good actor. You know, he's a sack of shit,
he's
but sometimes he could act.
So like sometimes that happens.
He also is pretty unrecognizable.
He is.
It is.
You know, again, it's another interesting thing where like Mel Gibson was probably the biggest name at the time when this came out.
For sure.
But you wouldn't know that it's him necessarily in this role.
Robin Wright.
I think she does good.
Yeah.
It's an underwritten character.
Well, all of them are really.
Yeah.
Well, that she plays even. But because, I mean, there's the crazy blonde character. There's the redhead character in the beginning who gets killed. And then she's also playing the wife.
Yeah, Nicola, his wife.
Yeah. I mean, again, much richer text to explore if you wanted to.
I imagine.
As an actor, play this character better. If you want, you could have read the series script.
I think
much more context.
Yeah.
She's called upon to play a lot of the same beats, which is mostly, I love this man, but he's an incredibly hurtful and hostile person.
Well, that and I'm a duplicitous viper screwing my husband out of his money.
But the bit, you called out a bit, I think, where they're having like almost a weird, he's sort of starting to like get, like the therapy's starting to kick in and he's starting to maybe be a bit less shit. So they're having a nice little moment and then it sort of devolves into him being like, and then we could screw right there and I'll
And
she's like, okay.
She's like, and
she kind of like draws back and you can almost see in her face, she's like, what time's the bus?
Yeah.
Right. So, all right. The nice moment is over.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we like comment. Jeremy Northam, I think it was nice to see him play a slimy
scumbag. Yeah, he's fun. And again, like, not really playing a character who gets explored in any meaningful way, but fun.
Mostly just sort of a, like, Freudian boogeyman, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
Katie Holmes just kind of doing, like, an ingenue.
Right. Like, not bad, but again, not a character.
And there's not much to do.
I think John Polito and Adrian Brody are really
fun.
I really like them. Like, super it's fun. One of those things where, like, I kind of wish there was an entire movie that just sort of followed these two characters around.
At least that they were two of a larger cast of characters at that kind of height, because they brought so much fun energy.
The one that's one of the best changes of having it be set in America is that you could make them these sort of like Chicago
like moves. Gangsters.
Just like hey.
No, they every time they were on screen, my interest levels spiked a little bit.
I don't know, it's
be a big good. Fucking moon.
And then I think everyone else that shows up does some great work. I mean, the doctors.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, Saul Rubinek and Alfre Woodard, they're like, they're doing fine jobs for like a pretty much a one scene role.
Alfre Woodard's face during The Hop.
Yeah, which she's like,
and she's just like, her mouth opens so wide and she's like,
she gets like very big with it. It's very fun. Good. Yes.
Yeah. And then I do like the Amy Aquino.
Yeah. As like the sort of mean nurse.
Yeah. Her sort of pinched face the whole time is
good. No, she has like resting grump face the entire movie. It's great.
Her responding to Robert Downey Jr. when he's just yelling in that scene, it was so good.
Yeah.
Carla Gugino plays his mom slash a prostitute, but it's basically the same thing each time. She sleeps with people, she dies.
Yeah. Alright, should we get into fixes?
Yeah. Do you mind if I go voice?
Go for it.
I sort of tipped in the direction I wanted to go, but similar to what Brendan and all of us were really saying, I liked the John Polito and Adrian Brody characters a lot. I think we needed more of that energy. One of the things that came to mind for me, I don't want it to be like mixed with animation in quite this way, but I think it needed some more Who Framed Roger Rabbit energy. In that it needed animated characters, but just both John Polito and Adrian Brody playing cartoon mobsters.
Yeah.
I think there was a version of this movie that could have been more successfully fun, perhaps in the way that I'm hearing that the TV show was. So we need the mobsters. I think we need a femme fatale. We kind of get some taste of that, but we need a more unified character. Maybe some kind of like police chief type or something like that. And I want these characters, as Dan Dark is sort of haphazardly putting this book together as he's going through medical treatment, I want these characters to inhabit the space with him. I want that collapse between these dimensions to come very quickly, because I think the sell of the movie is he's viewing all of this around him with this overlay of this like cartoonish noir novel that he's putting together in his head. I want him to respond to the cornier things they say. I think you can go for some really crazy monologues that you probably wouldn't sit as well in the real world. Instead of, like we were kind of talking about earlier, using a noir actual story, you're just using those elements to help him explore what he's going through. I think that makes a lot more sense. And I also want to spend more time with how he's actually psychologically getting over this, because that's clearly important to the movie. But like we had already said, it's basically like he has one amazing session with Dr. Mel Gibson and then he's cool with his wife afterward. And I'm not saying we need to do a like realistic portrayal of, you know, like mental health treatment, but we needed more to understand how you're getting well after that point. And I'm also way pumping the brakes on this woman or whores thing, because I get that as the movie's not endorsing that necessarily, but we spend so long on that note that it drags down any attempt to be like, and now he's fine at the end.
Yeah.
So
when you started your fix with, I really liked Adrian Brody and John Patillo's characters, I really thought we were heading towards like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
That would be fun.
And now that's all I want is that fix, but I will pitch the fix that I had.
Yeah.
Which is I'm giving this a very light touch, because I did just recently watch a lot of the series again, and it's a good series. It's hard to find, and it's 6 hours of your life that you should spend watching it. It is also hard to watch. Like, I got emotional watching the first episode, as a lot of dark shit happens. I think for the movie, again, if we must, if we must make this movie, which you don't need to make the TV.
No, we must.
Good, but if we have to shorten it, I'm going to take out, again, I want the mystery to sort of return to less of a focus on having a plot and just more, rather than it being like, you know, the seeing the sort of story within the story advance, but you set up scenes in act one, like the scene where the body is found, the scene where the girl gets killed, the scene where the killer's being confronted, etc. And those are the ones that you keep returning to throughout the movie, in different points, but like the context keeps switching or things, small things keep changing because the story, the narrative is changing in Dan Dark's head. Just to be less chronologically sound and more like surreal and like, what, you know, this is a constantly morphing story. He's going back and forth and, you know, have be less cohesive. And it's not about the story of the story making sense. It's just, again, like sort of part of the psychodrama of what's going on with him. I would add back in the element the series kind of cuts out, which is that the real root of his problems is a sense of guilt that he feels and that he has projected onto someone else that he can then kill or punish in his novels. And the journey being realizing that it's him that he needs to kill or punish to get better. If we're gonna get rid of the whole, you know, kid shitting on a test, which we have done, then again, the one I suggested is that maybe rather, like, you could start with this thing that, like, you know, my mom slept with a lot of guys, and that's the reason why my life went to shit, was because we had to, like, leave our life. But I think also, I think number one, realizing that their life was already shitty because the dad was abusive. And number two, the idea that, like, he actually doesn't really feel like his mom is at fault. He just feels guilty because his mom had to, like, do all of this stuff to support him is what he really cares about. And so he's maybe tried to, like, vilify his mom as, like, the reason why things are bad versus, like, he just feels responsible for it. And again, I think I would end it in a much less clear place, sort of sooner than maybe the series gets to with his journey, and imply that there's, like, a path toward recovery. I think the series also does, it does kind of end in the same exact way with, like, him walking off with his wife, getting the hat, etc. But I would maybe prefer it to be more ambiguous as to, like, is this going to last?
Yeah.
No, maybe not, but he's going to keep working on it.
Yeah.
And that's it. I wouldn't change a lot of the writing. Much like we didn't change a lot of it here, we just cut out some stuff that I think we could have maybe changed or change what we cut.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, that's
I like it.
All right, so here's the thing. Like I said previously, if you were to just do this as is, the biggest issue is that you just need a director who has a sense of style. I said David Lynch. I stand by that. That's something that would be interesting. If you are not doing that, now, here's the thing. Again, as I said earlier in the episode, why are you making this movie? Why does this movie exist? You have already made this. Like, it's one thing if you were adapting something and it had never been done well before, but you already did this well. You did this good. People liked it. Everyone was happy with it. So what are we doing with this now? So for a while, I was thinking that it was going to be just sort of more about him in the hospital writing the story, and the story was reflecting his reality, similar to this, but just with more of a focus on that. And then I was like, oh no, that's just the musical City of Angels, where, you know, that's kind of just what happens in that musical. So I didn't want to do it. So what I think, if I were doing this, what I think it would be is I think it would literally just be a straightforward detective story set in the 1950s, and the main character, Dan Dark, is a singer, is like an aspiring lounge singer who became a detective because he realized that singing does not pay well. And so it's literally just like this guy occasionally sings in bars, but his side hustle is being a detective.
I love this.
And so instead of following a conventional mystery, it's literally just going to be like, what happens when, like, these two sides of his personality sort of come into conflict with each other? One side is sort of like this dapper concept of a 1950s sort of musical comedy detective hero, and the other side is this actual noir detective. And how do you reconcile these two parts of yourself? And I think you can have singing in it that way, because it's almost going to be something like Chicago,
right?
When the character's brain is fried because of something that's happening emotionally, it goes into like a fictional world where the character is singing, you know, a pop or rock song from the 1950s. So you can have it in there that way. I think all of the psychological and emotional baggage that is given to the writer Dan Dark in this movie can kind of be dumped on the character of Dan Dark instead, because maybe it's not a conventional mystery that he's trying to figure out. Maybe he's literally just trying to figure out, like, who am I and what makes me tick? The actual mystery that he's sort of drawn into, he realizes doesn't really matter. The real issue is, what the fuck am I doing with myself? What is my life? Who am I? How do I, you know, rectify these two separate parts of me as a person? And that's what I have there. It's mostly just an exploration of this character who is sort of, like, you know, like one half noir detective and one half 1950s musical comedy hero.
We were kind of all driving towards the same thing of just, this should be about him as a person and not...
I mean, that seems like what the series is, so, like, yeah, probably.
Yeah, and I do think that's what the movie was trying to do.
Agreed.
I just think it missed the mark in what it...
Agreed.
Would we recommend the movie?
No. I think the movie's kind of boring and long. If it were maybe 15 or 20 minutes shorter, I could maybe get up behind it a little more. There is a surprising lack, I think, of lip-syncing songs, given that that was the one thing I knew about this. There's really only, like, five or six times, and the rest of it is just sort of 50 songs used as underscore. So, like, it doesn't even have that weird gimmick going for it fully for me.
Sure.
So, like, I would say, based on what I've seen, by all means, see the series. The series looks very good.
Yeah.
Don't see this.
Yeah, I definitely don't think you should only watch the movie.
Yeah.
For sure. But if it piques your interest to watch the series, good for you. But I think you should watch the series before the movie and maybe stop at the series.
Yeah. I would be very hard-pressed to recommend the movie unless you were doing a bad movie podcaster or you wanted to compare it to the series.
Like, right, unless you just watched the series and you were like, but how does the movie compare?
Yes.
Like, as an interesting thought experiment, but I can't imagine someone seeking this out, watching it, and really enjoying it.
I will say, like, I wouldn't have known about the TV show at a younger age. Unless I had seen the movie, like if the movie,
so like it did do its job in some respects, yeah.
So we have that to thank for the movie, I suppose. But
it's also one of those issues where, like, if you see a bad adaptation of something, are you necessarily going to seek out like the thing that it's based upon and be like,
yeah, I guess maybe not, but it's hard to know.
No, I know, I agree. Like, I'm not saying, like, I think you or I probably would, because I feel like we'd be interested in being like, like, how did this go wrong? But I feel like the average person, if they saw this and were like, this was bad, I have no desire to see anything else about it based on this.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, I was at that age where I was, like, fascinated by the movie in a way where, I don't think I could elucidate or, like, figure out why, like, that it was bad.
Yeah.
But just in a way that I'm like, this is a weird movie.
Yeah.
I don't know that I like it, but I will watch it again because I'm intrigued by it.
I think that's fair. This is also was a crazy ass musical.
Like, yeah, this is an unhinged musical.
It is,
sure is.
One of three.
Yeah. On that note,
Come
back at us in 2 weeks and we will talk about what unhinged musical we'll be doing next.
Yep.
And we'll also, I don't know, we'll figure out what we're going to talk about then.
Yeah, who knows?
No,
we'll figure something out.
We'll taste Oreos or whatever that was.
We'll taste some Oreos.
Yeah, we'll eat some Oreos.
And we'll have a riotous discussion.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the meantime,
drivepack.com is our website. We're on all the podcast apps. You can subscribe, listen, rate, etc. there. Now.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
In my dreams, you told me it's a love that can't compare. In my dreams, you told me it's love you wanna share. So hold me, hold me, hold me. Never ever let me go.